I guess that's what my work is all about. It's thinking, or rather expanding one's notion of what constitutes art history, what constitutes a visual world. And my interest in Black diasporal arts, in Black cultural subjectivity, suggests that I want people to think about, you know, the kind of varieties and possibilities in what one sees in a museum, in a gallery, or in everyday life.
Art historian Richard Powell. He'll be back in just a moment with more about artistic images of African Americans. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with the concluding segment in a series of programs for Black History Month 1996. Later on the show this week, literary critic Michael Valdez-Moses will be here to talk about his new book, The Novel and the Globalization of Culture. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Richard Powell is an art historian at Duke University. In a recent piece about history and memory in African American culture, he says that contemporary efforts by scholars have often failed to define a Black aesthetic. Yet, even in the absence of a comprehensive and practical definition, Richard Powell finds something of an organizing principle in the metaphor of the blues, which he says is a presence that endures in every artistic overture made toward African American peoples. Here is Richard Powell.
I guess I'm very postmodern when I talk about the use of images. I think that images are paintings and sculptures and prints and drawings, but they're also photographs and films and video images, advertisements.
Even music, you say. Am I right? You introduce that as a part of the mix?
Well, album covers are certainly right. Visual images of Blacks. I'm thinking about all those incredible album covers that I used to just be fascinated by that came out in the late 60s, early 70s, Miles Davis's Bitches Brew,
right.
Abraxas by Carlos Santana.
Oh, that's utterly memorable.
Yes. Images like those, I think, are a part of this larger category.
And yet you say that there are many misconceptions afoot out there, not only in the popular culture, but in that as well as the academic, interpretive work that goes on when you talk about Blacks.
This is an interesting moment as a scholar to be exploring some of these ideas. I think one of the biggest misconceptions and problems that people have when they think about notions of African American art or Black art and culture is that this kind of work is produced solely by Blacks or African Americans.
To put it very crudely, you've got to be Black to do Black.
Yes, and I think that whoever comes up with that kind of idea is losing sight of a whole series, several centuries of work that are very much products of all kinds of people who are focusing on Black cultural subjectivity. Just to kind of define that term, what I mean is that there are artists and kind of observers of culture who focus, who zoom in on the reality of a Black experience. I didn't say the Black experience. I said a Black experience. Because if we talk about Black experiences, we could cover everything from a Yoruba man in southwestern Nigeria to an African American such as myself growing up on the south side of Chicago to a Black Brazilian living in Rio de Janeiro. I mean, all of these are valid definitions of Black. It's just that they have very different representations and nuances attached.
But part of what you argue for is a kind of willful remembering. That is to say, the artist as a person who consciously organizes materials out of a personal or a social past and inserts them into the expressive culture.
Yes, but I would also add to that that part of that memory is an invented memory. Part of that memory is a constructed, a refabricated memory that might have to do with something that was actually experienced, but also might have to do with an understanding or a perception of the world that is truly out of someone's imagination. And that's what I think makes history and memory, such a real interesting kind of theme to kind of use to investigate so many of these objects.
Now, one of the artists that you've written about, Rick Powell, is a man named Aaron Douglas. He was born at the turn of the century, dies in 1979. We're at a bit of a disadvantage here. We're on the radio. We can't do pictures. But tell me about Douglas and why he is important to the scholarship that you're engaged in.
Douglas arrived in New York in 1925. He came to New York because he wanted to be a part of something called the New Negro Arts Movement. This was a group of scholars and social scientists and business types who wanted to bring more attention to the contributions and the potentials of African Americans. And they all gravitated to New York City. And Aaron Douglas was a part of this group. Within a year, I'd say, by 1926, he was painting murals and doing book illustrations that we could say are representative of something that you might call the Harlem Renaissance. Mm-hmm. These are images that are very stylized. They are very geometric. They show figures and landscapes, but done in a very, very flat, almost silhouette style. And they use gradations of tone from dark purples to kind of middle range purples to lavenders, and he often juxtaposes or contrasts those tones with lighter degrees. So his works are very abstract, at the same time they're very figurative.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. How would you characterize the blend in Douglas's work between we have to stretch for a vocabulary here to create this middle ground, I guess, that we're looking for between the ethnic, between the American political social machinery that he inhabited, and then these deeply personal and racial memories that certainly must have inspired his work.
You know, as a scholar, I can probably look at a work of his and cut it up into all those different categories.
Uh-huh, but you don't want to do that.
Exactly. You got it.
Fair enough.
Because he's one person. And he brings all of these issues, the history of African Americans and his own personal experience as a black Midwesterner who arrives in Harlem uh-huh. in the mid-1920s. He's listening to the music from that time period, people mm-hmm. like Jimmy Lunsford, or probably a little bit earlier, people like Duke Ellington right. and others. And he's really trying to put some of those rhythms and some of those sensibilities into his work. He has a wonderful statement that he made in the 1920s in collaboration with Langston Hughes. And he talks about, I want to paint something as if it is objectively mystical. And he uses terms that are almost contradictory, but it's very clear that what he's after is something that I call or coin a blues aesthetic.
Here, you have raised a very important term. We're not talking just about music. You mentioned Duke Ellington and names like Count Basie come to mind, but we're not talking about just what's in the ears. We're talking about what's in the mind, visually as well as aurally.
Yeah, and we're talking about a cultural ethos. I mean, if we take that moment, 1926. It was an extraordinary moment in terms of black culture. I mean, yes, we have incredible musicians, many of whom were blues musicians, mm-hmm. but we also have writers, people like Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston. We have dancers and various types of performers in theater. I mean, moving from everything from Paul Robeson to Ubi Blake. Mm-hmm. We also have classical music happening at the same time. People also like Paul Robeson. But I'm thinking about Marian Anderson as well, or Roland Hayes. Mm. This is a real moment of reawakening, or as opposed to a rebirth. It's almost as if, to use the term Renaissance, implies that there's this kind of dormancy there. But here again, I think that there's this kind of flow and from the 19th century into the 20th century that really comes to a head during the time that Aaron Douglas is working. And it very much makes what we see in his work possible.
Rick, how would you characterize the contemporary scene when we speak of locating and interpreting, understanding artistic images of African Americans in American, North American mass culture? We look back to the Harlem Renaissance. Was that it? Were those the glory days? I mean, was it downhill from there? What's going on?
I'm laughing because during that time period, Laureate, I think someone asked Zora Neale Hurston, well, you know, is the blues dead? She says, well, unfortunately it is. She says, you know, now that we have radios, now that we have recordings, people are not doing live music anymore. And
right.
of course, it's kind of absurd to say it's dead because it grows, it transforms. And I'd say that the 80s and the 90s is a particularly exciting moment in terms of black art mm-hmm. in the world, not just in North America, in Europe, in the Caribbean. But if we just focus on the U.S., I mean, we have amazing photographers and filmmakers and painters and sculptors who are very conscious of a history and who have a memory of a past mm-hmm. that's both a real memory and a re-remembered or a refabricated memory. And that gets worked out in some amazing ways. I'm thinking about a contemporary artist whose work I happen to like. Her name is Carrie Mae Weems. She's a photographer who works out of New York City. She did this amazing piece in 1989 called Ode to Affirmative Action. And it's she does it as an album cover.
Uh-huh.
And so what you see is an album cover, and it says, "If You Should Lose Me." That's the title of the album cover. And it shows a picture of the artist holding a microphone a mic in her hand.
Right.
And it looks as if she's singing. It looks like some sort of album cover that might have come from the 1960s or 50s or something, because she's mm-hmm. dressed in kind of a gaudy dress. But the whole point is that she's playing with this idea of history, this idea of a past, and she's refabricating it, rethinking it, for the realities of 1980s, 1990s, a la this issue of affirmative action, this issue of placement and belonging, rather, as opposed to non-belonging or non-placement.
Fair enough. Now, let me argue with you for mm-hmm. briefly here, Rick. Whether we're speaking of the artist you just mentioned, the photographer, or of African-American art generally, does it always have to have a political, social, kind of heavy-handed, ideological weight to it? How does it connect with that very dangerous term, tradition, and all the other artists who have breathed the air and picked up their paints and written their notes, that large expressive culture?
Again, I think one of the great things about this moment is that there's a lot of breadth in what one can see and what one can appreciate. I think there are a lot of artists now who are very, very interested in politics. This is a very political, contentious time mm-hmm. that we're in.
But that's not the only thing.
Exactly, exactly. I think there are other artists, and we've always had artists in an African-American tradition who have been interested in more cerebral issues,
mm-hmm.
color, rhythm, form,
mm-hmm.
And yet I would argue that while those images might be abstract and while they may not plug into the specifics of a political or a polemic kind of situation, that they are nonetheless very much a part of an African-American tradition in their fascination with more abstract kinds of ideas and themes.
Richard J. Powell is an art historian who teaches at Duke University. He's at work on a new study of subjugation and agency in 19th century images of blacks. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with the concluding segment in a series of programs for Black History Month 1996. In just a moment, a conversation with literary critic Michael Valdez Moses. He's here to talk about his new book, The Novel and the Globalization of Culture.
Among the most vivid memories of my childhood are the long, warm afternoons I spent in my grandparents' home in Los Angeles, listening to my great-grandmother and her children tell stories of the Mexican Revolution. Under the avocado trees that vaulted over the stone patio next to the house, with its whitewashed walls and Spanish tile roof, I sat while my great-aunt, Carmen Salas, recalled the day in 1914 when, as a young girl, she watched helplessly as her father was assassinated on the streets of Valparaíso, Zacatecas, stabbed and shot by Pancho Villa's men. I heard my great-grandmother, Margarita Salas y Banuelos, bitterly recall how her husband's body was brought home over the back of a horse, how she had lost her father, three brothers, and a first cousin in the revolution. Our hacienda had been burned to the ground. I listened to my grandmother, Margarita Valdez, and her brother and sister, Consuelo and Pedro, remember the day and night they spent as children, without food or water, hiding between the inner and outer walls of an abandoned adobe house, on the run from the villistas who were hunting down the hacendados. They recollected their struggle to keep still. Almost a half century later, they could still feel the ants crawling over their skin in the dark.
Literary critic Michael Valdez Moses. His new book is entitled The Novel and the Globalization of Culture. It's a study that brings together canonical European authors with writers from the Third World in an effort to analyze the emergence of the modern novel and the way it mirrors the underlying process of cultural globalization. One of the book's important themes is the relation of race to artistic representation. Michael Valdez Moses is a professor of English at Duke University. I asked him to explain the term, the globalization of culture.
What I mean by modernization or modernity or the modern is a process which I think involves about really sort of four primary aspects. One is modern natural science and its product, modern technology. A second is secularization, by which I mean that the gradual abandonment of organized religion as the fundamental basis for society. Third would be capitalism, the emergence, growth, and spread of market economies. And finally, the legitimacy of democratic rule and democratic principles. Modernization has affected societies all over the world.
You say that this is a tragic kind of process. That is to say, you're paraphrasing some of your philosophical and literary forebears here. Tell me about that.
Right. In the 19th century, and even well into the 20th century, I think there was a confident faith in the positive and progressive nature of the development of Western civilization and its effect on civilizations elsewhere. In retrospect, we see that many, many millions of people suffered as a result of that. And one would have to say they also benefited. And that is the nature of a tragedy, that we can have both positive and negative consequences from that conflict.
How does the novel, as an artistic form of expressive culture, how does that enter into the discussion?
Well, I was interested in looking at novels that that represented traditional societies at that moment in which, if you will, modern Western practices descended upon them. I say Western, I should really say only modern, because indeed what I try to demonstrate is that one can find novelists from the West who look back on the history of European societies and find that they too were convulsed in these tragic conflicts between the forces of modernization and traditional values and customs.
Name some names here for me, Michael.
Thomas Hardy, mm-hmm. Joseph Conrad, Chenoa Achebe, Mario Vargas Llosa are the principal novelists mm-hmm. who I examine in this work.
Now, this is an ambitious thing to do and to take it not only to academic but to popular audiences. They are not necessarily household names in American. I suppose among you professors they are household names.
I hope so, at least among us professors.
Let's pause, for example, on Joseph Conrad in the West, so to speak, mm-hmm. and then let's look at a writer like Chenoa. Pronounce it for me, Chenoa Achebe.
That's
who
right.
is a Nigerian writer. What's going on in the interplay there?
Well, I think in Conrad's case, what I've suggested in examining Lord Jim, one of his most important and best-known novels, is really a novel about how an individual character, Jim, fails in the West in large part because of things that we really don't like very much about Western society, the absence of community, the sense of alienation, the feeling that one's actions are meaningless in a secularized society.
Well, let me stop you for a minute. These are the upshots of what we call the modern.
Right.
And we all like to have our McDonald's hamburgers. We want to have our popular culture. What is it, a price that we're willing to pay, all of this talk of individual alienation?
Yeah, indeed. What I'm suggesting is that there are costs and benefits, successes and failures to modernization. And it would be naive to assume that modernity is simply a good thing. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in exploring how it is that we both arrived at modern societies and also what we've gained and lost as a result of that.
Well, talk for a couple of minutes, Michael, about Achebe. Here is, a Nigerian novelist in whose work you say it's great because it demonstrates, it crystallizes this encounter between the traditional and the modern, mm-hmm. and it shows why the modern was inevitable in its victory. Large order there for you.
Right. Well, what I would stress is that Achebe feels that modern Nigeria has emerged from different traditions, both in this particular case, from Igbo tribal traditions as well as modern Western European ones and Christian traditions as well, which are brought together in such a way that in his novel, Things Fall Apart, they come into serious conflict, and the hero of Achebe's novel, a man named Okonkwo, is destroyed in the process, as is the traditional society which he represents.
What about his heroic characteristics? Are they utterly obviated, that is to say, the characteristics of the hero here?
I think his heroism is in part a result of his standing up for traditional beliefs, which become increasingly anachronistic. In fact, his great tragedy is that he becomes the last representative of an old way of life, mm-hmm. having once exemplified what members of his society once most admired. He becomes an outcast and indeed commits suicide at the end of this novel, mm-hmm. As a result of the collapse of the society which he formerly represented.
Michael, again, your book is The Novel and the Globalization of Culture. You say that in the dynamics of the fiction that you write about in your study, there is the tragic encounter between the master and the slave. What is that all about?
I would describe the process of modernization as an attempt to overcome that conflict. The cheery Pollyanna view would be somehow that they can shake hands and walk away.
Right.
But in fact, what I emphasize is the tragic conflict between those two, that in effect both master and slave are destroyed in the process, to be sure, sometimes as individuals, sometimes as whole societies.
But they are bound together. I mean, they can't get away
right.
from one another.
Ultimately, they are. And indeed, the thesis with which I operate here is that the tension between master and slave is finally overcome, and a principle of equality becomes increasingly the only legitimate one in world history.
Now, wait.
But in the course of that process, uh-huh. millions of people are destroyed. Whole civilizations are wiped out.
I was about to say, the principle of equality or the practice of equality?
Well, I think the principle of equality is established first, and indeed it would be naive of me to suggest that we've achieved that ideal. I think the principles are articulated at a certain moment of time, I suggest that for the first time, in the French Revolution. But of course, that only affects a very small corner of one Western European nation. Mm-hmm. And 200 years later, the fight for equality is still waged in many parts of the world, and indeed tens of thousands, if not millions of people, continue to risk their lives for just such a goal.
Michael, as we look at the forces of the modern exerting themselves on traditional societies, primitive societies, what gets lost in this equation?
I think a number of very important things get lost. Among them is a loss of a spiritual or religious existence, one which is intense, ecstatic, uplifting. That can be lost.
Let me stop you for a moment. It's the difference between the rational and the superstition, between the magical world and the world of operating rooms and things like that.
I think that's right. That we may view it as merely subjective if we're secularists. But nevertheless, even secularists like Salman Rushdie feel as if there's this tremendous emotional loss, a sense as if a void has been created in the self as a result of this process of modernization. I think a couple of other things that are also lost is that sense of a tightly knit organic community that in modern societies, because of their scale, the anonymity of living in them, we tend to feel isolated. We don't feel as if we belong to a community which is meaningful for us.
Well, a lot of these books that you write about in this account of the novel and the globalization of culture go to familial themes and retaining that sense of the microcosmic community. That's much on the minds of these novelists.
Yes. Achebe's Things Fall Apart or Hardy's The Mayor of Casterbridge are really rooted in communities which are not fully modernized and in which the family, the clan, the tribe are paramount in the lives of the principal characters. And for their families to disintegrate means, in effect, that the whole world that they know is dissolved.
Well, here we go to his title, Things Fall Apart. Isn't it a kind of an irony that in writing about what, for the purposes of your book, you call the Third World, he's drawing on a line from a very, very much a First World poet?
Right, of Yeats, which is precisely my point, that that there are real disagreements between writers from the First and the Third World, but I think their subject matter is very often drawn from the same well of universal human experience.
Michael Valdez-Moses is the author of The Novel and the Globalization of Culture, available from Oxford University Press. Michael Valdez-Moses teaches at Duke University, where he serves as Director of Graduate Studies in the Department of English. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with the concluding segment in a series of programs for Black History Month 1996. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Audio cassettes are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 804. That's $10, program number 804. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week, the first of two programs in recognition of Women's History Month 1996. Writer Amy Tan will be here to read from and talk about her latest bestseller, a novel entitled The Hundred Secret Senses. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.